Okay. I feel immense relief, honestly. Being without some means of escape feels awful. Hook me up with that. I'll give you a credit card number. Thank you. He nods, clearly wanting it to be no big thing. I leave it there. I sit and nurse my coffee while he makes the calls. My kids are still sleeping, and I just want to crawl in and join them. But I can't. Even here, surrounded by supposedly impartial county deputies, I can't really relax. I'm not even sure why. But I just feel like there's more to this, more coming. I need to find a way to bail Sam out of this mess, fast. And I need to protect my children from this circling, dark storm. Right now, those two feel like opposite goals. But something in the back of my mind is telling me that they aren't. Not really. That the solution to everything is in a town I'd rather not go back to, and people I'd rather not face again. Wolf Hunter isn't finished with us. Yet. The cruiser takes us to the Motel 6. The officer walks in with us and, once we're in the two adjoining rooms, tells us that he'll be out in the parking lot until we're ready to go back to the county sheriff's office for that rental car. I intend to sleep. I do. The kids are definitely worn out. They crash in the two beds in their room, exhausted as they've ever been. But not me. I can't stop. I'm worn to a thread, but I keep moving. Thinking about Sam. Thinking about V. Crockett. Thinking about the spiraling disaster of my life. I keep the connecting door open for a while, but the mounting panic inside me needs an outlet, and I finally shut it, go to the bed, and curl up on my side. I put the pillow to my face. I shatter. The pillow stifles the sound that boils out of me like steam. It's pure grief, pure anguish, pure hell. When it finally stops, it isn't because I don't hurt inside. It's because I just can't find the breath to scream anymore. I gasp for air. I tuck myself into a protective ball and pray, pray, pray that I can find a way to live through this one more time. I meant what I said to Sam. I'm not running away from Stillhouse Lake. I can't. Whatever comes, we have to meet it here in the house that we made a home, in a town that doesn't want us. I thought the lake would drown the last traces of Melvin Royal forever. But he's not gone. He's never going to be gone. The damage he did to me, to us, is permanent. Melvin would laugh to see me like this. Paralyzed, traumatized. It's what he would have wanted. I put the pillow aside. I'm still shaking. I'm raw and bleeding inside. But the thought of Melvin's satisfied grin makes me sit up. Take deep breaths, and get myself the fuck together. The path out of this might be black and full of sharp edges, but I'll find my way. And Sam? What about Sam? I know he's wandering the same dark territory that I am. He's hiding something from me. But he's also the man who came after me when I was alone and hurt and desperate. The man who helped me find my children when they were lost. The man who cracked Absalom, who saved Connor just yesterday. Doesn't that count, too? Can't there be some way, any way, back to the light for both of us? My head aches from the emotion and stress, and I get up and go to the bathroom. I study myself in the mirror, fine lines etched lightly on my forehead, at the corners of my lids, a distant, shocked look and reddened eyes. I look like someone who's seen hell and lived. That's something to rest on for a moment. My cell phone rings and I put it on the bathroom counter to see who's calling. I don't know the number, but I answer it anyway.
I need to talk to you, a cool, elegant voice says. I'd like to come inside.
Inside? It's a second later that I realize who it is. And the ice inside me grows into a glacier. I hang up the call. I look at myself in the mirror again. Then I go to the door and open it to face Miranda Nelson Tidewell. Out in the parking lot, the deputy gets out of his cruiser and comes toward us. Miranda must know he's coming.
She doesn't turn to look. She's taller than I am, thinner in the way that some rich people are, as if she's dieted away half her ribcage, dressed in a black shirt and jeans. A brooch with a gold bird is the only jewelry, and I know she wears it because her daughter loved birds and was in school to become a vet. "Everything all right, Miss Proctor?" the deputy asks me. He has his hand on the butt of his gun. He can't figure out what's going on between the two of us. I'm not sure I can, either. Miranda raises her perfectly shaped eyebrows, a cool, calm challenge. "We're all right," I tell him. "She's going to come in for coffee." He doesn't like it, but he nods and goes back to his cruiser. "Coffee," Miranda says. She sounds amused. "I can't imagine what kind of trash this place must have available, but by all means, let's be civilized." We just stare at each other for a long moment. She has haunting eyes, the kind of blue that seems like Arctic ice, with color that shifts with her mood. Pale blonde hair, going gray in graceful swoops. I move back, and she steps inside. I don't take my eyes off her as I shut and lock the door. She's the one who ought to be afraid. After all, she's now locked in here with me. But she's not, in any way I can detect. She examines the room clinically, and while she seems mildly revolted, she says, "Are your children here?" "Not in the room," I say. "Next door." "Good." She suddenly meets my gaze. "I'm sorry they've been made part of this." "Well, that's a lie," I say. "You want me to feel your pain, the pain of a mother losing her children. You think I don't know that? I saw it on your face every day during my trial. I admit, I thought you moved on with your life, but here you are, still." "Here I am." She's studying me, trying to read me. "I find it obscene that they let you keep those children, considering what you've done." I still haven't raised my voice, though I want to. "And what is it I've done, besides survive a man even you have to admit was a monster?" "You enabled him, you supported him, you helped." "I survived. My daughter didn't." Her expression doesn't alter. I'm not sure that it can. The plastic surgery is brilliant, but the effect is unnatural. Nevertheless, I see something move underneath, like a creature shifting in its shell. "How far are you going to go with this documentary?" I ask her. "Coming after me is one thing. Involving my kids? That's not okay. Are you planning to hound Sam, too?" "Sam, well, he chose his bed. Literally, it seems." The distaste just steams off her words. "Sam certainly knew who Gina Royal really was, at least before he went to Stillhouse Lake. And yet you were still able to twist him all out of shape." "I'm very tired, Miranda. Why are you here?" I ask it bluntly, because I'm already sick of playing her game, and the urge to rip out a handful of that perfectly ordered hair is pretty strong. "You helped kill my daughter, and I want to know why a mother would do that, how a mother could do that, and not slit her own throat." There it is, finally. Right out in the open. A naked statement, not even clothed in anger. She's stating a fact, as she sees it, and demanding an explanation. "Melvin Royal killed your daughter," I tell her. "Melvin Royal didn't need or want my help. He was a serial killer. He fantasized and planned and stalked and abducted and murdered all by himself. I'm alive because I was stupid. Because I believed him when he told me he was working late, or making tables in his workshop. And do you know why? Because on some level, he frightened me. And I was afraid to even begin to find out why." I catch my breath. "You have no idea how much that hurts when I look back at it. How sorry I am that I didn't become what I needed to be, when it would have saved lives." If she was expecting a full confession, she's disappointed. But I can't tell what Miranda is feeling. She's a frozen lake of a woman, with something dark swimming deep beneath the surface. She turns and walks to the tiny desk. I feel myself go still as my instincts and training start to kick in. "Do you know how long I've wanted to do this? Talk to you face to face?" she asks me. She holds up one of the cheap foam cups. "I believe you mentioned you might make some coffee." I put in a filter, tear open a packet, add the water. It takes time, and we don't talk as the coffee slowly brews into the two-cup pot. I pour. She stands to drink it, sipping with elegant little motions. Her gaze moves around, missing nothing. "I wanted to see your face when I asked you about Melvin," she says. "And what did it tell you?" I ask. "That you lie very well." She drinks. I wait. "Well enough, you've even convinced Sam. And I never thought that would be possible. If you'd known him when I met him, you'd have been shocked how angry he was, how bitter, and how dedicated to hurting you. Has he told you that?" She leans against the counter, hot coffee in her cup. No other weapon I can see except the brooch she wears. It's strange, but I can feel her violence. I can feel the boundless hate inside her, blackening the space between us. The worst thing about Miranda is that I know her hatred comes out of an even greater grief. It makes it very hard to want to hurt her, and so easy for her to want to see me dead. "Why did you let me in?" she asks. "You could have left me standing on the doorstep. You didn't have to acknowledge me at all, yet you did." "My husband murdered your daughter," I tell her. "I do acknowledge you. I know you blame yourself for not being able to protect your child. I've spent years trying to protect mine. I understand your rage perfectly. I just wish it wasn't aimed at me." She doesn't answer, but she puts down the half-finished coffee. I watch her hands. One goes in her pocket. I tense all over. I can't imagine she has something in her pocket. I can't see any outline of anything dangerous, but I can't afford to be wrong. "Do you even understand why you obsess about me instead of Melvin?" I ask her. "Your husband's dead. I can't hurt him." "You didn't target him even when he was still alive," I said. "You came after me." "Why do you think that is?"
"Because you got away with it."
"Because in your narrow little world, it was my job to keep my husband happy, right? My duty to satisfy him in ways that kept him away from your daughter, and I didn't do that. But I wasn't Melvin's keeper. His sins were his own." She flinches. It's a small thing, but I see it.
"You knew. Your neighbor saw you helping him. There was a video of you with him taking a girl inside."
"The neighbor lied for attention. The video is faked. The FBI proved it. Do you really believe every wild theory that you think proves your case?"
"I'm going to see you destroyed."
"Get in line, Miranda. You don't even rate the time it takes to get a restraining order." Now she's glaring.
"The Lost Angels will carry on making your life a misery. If I can't have justice for Vivian, then at least I can have some comfort knowing you'll suffer the rest of your life for what you've done."
She's quick. I give her that. I'm looking at the welling fury in those cold eyes, and her hand comes out of her pocket. I see something in it. I dive sideways, hit the floor as I pull the gun from the shoulder holster, and bring it into line, dead center, on her heart. I cannot die here. My children need me. I'm a fraction of pressure from killing her when I realize that though both her hands are raised in a stabbing motion, she has no knife. She has a cell phone. Her face is bone white, but she looks exultant, like a martyr giving up her soul. She intended this. She walked in here ready to die, glad to die, if it sends me to prison. I ease off the trigger. The exultation fades from her face. She shuts down, and for a second, neither of us moves. Then she says, I really thought that would work.
It's a mild, careless observation. She lowers her hands. It terrifies me how close she came. If I'd shot her, it would have looked like cold-blooded murder. She wouldn't have had a weapon. Chances are I'd have been convicted. I myself told the deputy to let her inside. I'd only have my word to back up a justified shooting, and no proof at all. They'd play the TV show Confrontation at my trial. Case closed. I shake off the adrenaline rush as I holster the gun again. Well, it didn't, did it? I say. I climb back to my feet. Now you can leave, and I never want to see your face again. Not here, not near me, not around my kids. Whatever sick thing you and Sam might have had once, it's over. Leave him alone, too. Understand? We don't forget, she says. The Lost Angels are never going to stop. Never until you get what you deserve. If Sam gets in the way of that, so be it. The only thing Sam and I deserve is peace, I tell her. So do you, by the way. I hope you find it. Now get the fuck out of my room. Her mouth tightens a little at that.
Still a vulgar mouth on you, she says.
Good. I wouldn't want anyone to feel sorry for you. Before she leaves, she delivers the lowest parting blow she can. Tell Sam I miss him. I want to pull the gun and empty the magazine into her straight, arrogant back. I don't. I wait until she's gone, and then I collapse back to the bed, shaking. She came so close. No. I did.
Chapter 13. Sam. I don't like being in jail. It's my first time, and it feels worse than I imagined it would. I'm not claustrophobic, can't be a pilot if you are, but the walls close in anyway. Despite what I said to Gwen before they led me out, I feel lost now, very much on my own, in a place that feels like the belly of the proverbial beast. 2 hours in, I'm trying to close my eyes and not daring to really sleep, when a voice from outside the bar says,
"Open in number 6.
I'm in number 6. I hear the rattle of the lock, and I sit up fast, already reaching for the makeshift blackjack I've put together. I feel pretty stupid when Mike Lustig ducks under the too low opening and steps inside. The cell locks behind him, but he doesn't seem to notice. He nods toward the weapon.
That soap in your sock, or are you just happy to see me? Jesus, man.
I put it down and sink onto the narrow, shallow bunk. The mattress feels like it's filled with crushed scorpions.
The hell are you doing here?
You're in jail. Dumb question. I didn't think you'd want to risk your new shiny rep associating with a felon.
First off, I'm not associating. I'm investigating. Second off, shut your damn mouth. Did you talk to them?
Facts only, I tell him as he leans against the wall. He's a big dude, Mike. Bigger than you'd think would fit into a pilot's cockpit. But he's damn good despite his size. He takes up a lot of this small space.
Nothing but facts.
You know better, he says. Any word comes out of your mouth they can twist, and right up in here, they will. I stop and look at him. Really look. He's tired. He's come all the way from D.C., probably on his own dime, to help me.
Gwen called, I say. Hell yes, she did. Good thing, too, because I guarantee you that in this snake pit, you'd have some episode by morning and end up either dead or beaten half to it.
He puts scare quotes around episode.
Killing a cop's bad enough, but killing a small-town cop in a town that thinks of the civil wars being waged last week? Only way it gets worse for you is if you're black, which you're lucky you're not.
But you are, I say. Maybe this isn't the place for you.
Oh, no, son, it's exactly the place for me, Mike says. I'm your best friend until the judge I woke up gets your bail hearing done.
I had a bail hearing. I didn't get any.
We're revisiting.
Oh, I shake my head. Thanks, but don't you dare put up the cash.
Why, you planning on cutting out on me?
Not unless they say I can't leave town. I mean it, though. Don't. FBI agents are not wealthy, and Mike's putting himself in debt for this already. Gwen and the kids, they're okay? He changes position, and I'm immediately on guard. The dread sets in when he speaks, because he's changed tone, too. He now sounds professionally comforting. They're fine, man. Listen, there was a problem, but they're okay. I want to say that up front. I stand up. It isn't voluntary. I need to be on my feet. What happened? Someone came after them on the road, he says. The car shot to shit, but they're not hurt. Who? My knuckles hurt, and I realize I've balled my hands into fists. Who the fuck? He's held up his hands to fend off the anger. Don't know yet, he says. We've got a description of a truck and a guy dead on the road. She didn't kill him. He got thrown out of the truck when it spun out. We'll find the driver soon enough and ask some questions. Who's we? Me, for a start. Plus there's a pretty decent TBI investigator. Fairweather? Yeah. Got a good rep. We'll add people when we find decent ones. Not that we're likely to find many in Wolf Hunter proper. Rot spreads, and this town smells like it's got it in the bones. Mike's getting almost lyrical about it, but I don't doubt his instincts. Not for a hot second. Tell me again that they're okay. Yeah, man. They're okay. They're at the county sheriff's substation about half an hour out to the west. They'll be there all night, most likely. Soon as I know more, you'll know. I slowly sink back down on the bed. It doesn't feel any better, but I stretch out anyway. They need protection. Fairweather's on that, I asked. You should go. Ain't going nowhere until you are. I sigh, feel it deep, like the exhaustion. Thanks, Mike. Yeah, remember me at bonus time. Like I'm ever going to be able to afford you. Another charity asshole. He digs a phone out of his pocket and a pair of earbuds. Here, listen. I send him a look and put the earbuds in, not sure what the hell he's doing, and then he plays Gwen's message. I close my eyes, listening, hearing, the real emotion in her voice. And when she says, I love you, my eyes open and I stare at the dark ceiling. The ghostly light of the phone throws everything into sharp relief. She doesn't know how much I don't deserve that, and how much I need it to hear it. I strip off the earbuds and hand back the phone. Don't delete it, I tell him. Send it to me. He doesn't ask why, proving once again, I can pick good friends when I try. We make up a chess set out of spare change and random junk, and play until the guard comes back to unlock the door.
Judge is ready, he says. Let's go.
I've got him, Mike says, and takes my arm.
To be fair to the guard, it looks like he's capable of ripping the arm off, which is probably why I don't get shackles like I did earlier. It makes walking easier, at least.
Try to look pitiful. Oh, wait. You nailed it already.
Shut up. He walks me through the gates. The ride to the courthouse is about 2 minutes. I wonder if Mike's as alert as I am, because it's a chilly pre-dawn now, mist rising up from the ground like escaping ghosts, and we're alone in a police car with two of Wolf Hunter's finest, neither of whom look friendly. We could disappear, end up dead on the banks of Wolf Hunter River like the woman Connor and I found, or never be found at all. Still, making a prominent FBI agent disappear is probably too big a magic trick for this town to pull off. Hopefully. The only cars on the street this time of morning are three police cruisers and a surprising number of black SUVs. I point at one that's parked near the courthouse. That yours? Mike nods. Why? You bring company? He gets it in the next second as he takes in the other similar vehicles. No, he says. They don't look too local. They don't, I agree. I count three of them in view right now. It's a lot of strangers. You sure they're not FBI? TBI? I'm sure, Mike says. How many people you think it would take to secure this town? The whole town? I think he's kidding for a second. He isn't. One main road in and out, so a couple of cars ought to do it. If you mean locking down resistance, you'd want to hit the police station first, right?
Right,
he says. But that hasn't happened.
Not yet.
He doesn't say anything else. We're not close enough to read license plates in this dim light, or I'm sure he'd be jotting them down or taking a picture. Mike's got a theory, I think. He's just not telling me what it is. Once we're out of the car and inside the courthouse, I breathe a little easier. The judge is a grumpy old man from out of town. He's made all the more angry by the hour, and the fact he must have been rousted out of bed by someone at the highest state levels to get this done. He gestures to the yawning court clerk, who calls the case, and I realize my lawyer isn't here. Well, shit. It doesn't seem to matter. The judge just makes a pronouncement that seems like he's reading it from a card.
Based on my review of additional evidence, I'm amending the earlier decision and granting bail to the defendant in the amount of $250,000. Usual conditions apply.
That must be shorthand, because the court clerk keeps typing as if more's been said, and for quite a while. The judge waits until she stops, then bangs the gavel and rushes out. He's still got on pajamas under the robe, looks like. I can't imagine his next defendant is going to have a very good time of it.
$250,000?
I say to Mike when he comes to claim me. Yeah, don't bother to tell me you haven't got it handy.
Man, I don't got it at all, but you're in luck. Someone does.
It's not Gwen. She does have some cash socked away, but definitely not that much. Mike walks me out, and I don't know what I'm expecting when we hit the sidewalk, but I balk when I recognize the car. It's a rented Buick. Mike opens the door and gestures me in to sit beside Miranda Tidewell.
Are you fucking kidding me? I ask him. Mike, come on. Just get in. You needed an angel. She's the opposite.
Miranda leans out and says,
Sam, don't make me regret my investment in you. Please get in. Listen to what we have to say.
I look at her, then at Mike Lustig.
So it's we now.
I feel doors shutting inside me. Ties being cut. I've counted on Mike and his friendship for a long time, longer than I knew Miranda. I never thought anything could shake that trust, or break it. But I feel that chain coming apart now, link by link.
Get in, man,
he tells me again. I could walk away, but fact is, where would I go? Gwen isn't here, and she's dealing with worse than this. I get into the car. Mike climbs in on the passenger side up front, and the entire sedan groans and settles a little.
Well, I say to Miranda, at least you didn't make him your chauffeur. Even for you, maybe that's a bridge too far.
Fuck you, Mike says. You think I did this for money? I don't know, Mike. Why don't you tell me why else you colluded with a woman you know I hate?
Mr. Lustig has your best interests at heart, Sam, Miranda says.
She pulls the car out from the curb and starts driving. I don't know where we're going, and I don't like it.
Someone needed to help save you from yourself. If Mike and I colluded, I promise it's because we both still care.
Oh, you care now, I say it flatly, and I hope she can feel the slap. She sinks back into her seat and stares straight ahead.
Yes,
she says,
I do, somehow. Even with everything you've done to push me away.
I remember that tone, that voice. Low and with a faint rasp to it, like a cat's tongue. It's like falling back into the past, and it scares the hell out of me. Miranda doesn't look quite like herself, her hair's down, spilling in smooth waves over her shoulders. She's wearing a plain black shirt and blue jeans. Expensive, of course. She wouldn't be caught dead in some regular store brand. But she's as casual as I've ever seen her when not under the influence. And then I realize she's drunk. Not wildly drunk, like she used to get. But enough.
What did you do?
I ask her. My voice sounds tight now.
I saw Gina,
she tells me.
Don't worry. I didn't spill your secrets. I just wanted to test her a little.
Did you hurt her?
I don't realize how angry I am until I hear the sound of my voice. Mike's hand clamps down on my shoulder. He recognizes that tone. The way I've shifted forward, ready to lunge.
Don't, Mike. Did you hurt her?
No,
Miranda finally says.
She's fine, and so are the children, apparently. I didn't see them.
That's something. It lets me step back from a very long drop.
Why would you do that?
She's dragging you right down with her, Miranda says. That doesn't have to happen. I don't want that to happen, Sam. I never did. I care too much to watch you debase yourself like this.
Then don't watch. Go back to Casey and leave us alone, I tell her. Let it go.
Her face flushes, little hard dots of red in her cheeks and forehead. She can't keep herself quite as icily calm when she's drunk.
You're not a mother. I had a child carried in my body and she was absolutely destroyed. Someone has to pay for that.
Someone did, I say. Melvin Royal got a bullet in his head.
You, of all people, knew she was guilty, too. And now you're letting her get away with it.
Yeah, I was angry and deluded. I got better. You should try it.
The documentary will be made, she says. Your lives will still fall apart, because Gina coming out of the shadows was the beginning of the end for whatever you think your relationship was. You ought to be smart enough to realize that.
She reaches into her pocket and brings out a folded piece of paper. She hands it to me. It's a printed article from the internet. In it, someone is earnestly talking about Gwen Proctor as a full partner in her husband's crimes. It's not from 5 years ago. It's brand new.
I didn't print the comments section, she says, but I can promise you there are thousands posting, and they're just as full of rage as they ever were, if not more so. No one believes in her innocence. No one but you. And once the documentary is out, no one ever will again. She'll have no peace from now on, but we will have some measure of justice.
Jesus, the monster in this equation isn't Gwen. It's sitting next to me, and I helped create it.
Call them off.
You started it, Sam. You're the one who founded the Lost Angels, the one who made up the wanted posters with her picture we used around the neighborhoods every time we found her. You pushed us to follow her every move, track her aliases, keep showing up and driving her away. The one who came up with the idea to prove once and for all just how guilty she really is by moving in next door to her at Stillhouse Lake. Why would I call them off? I trusted you to finish this for all of us, and instead, you fell in love with her.
The edge sharpens on the last of that. Ah, God, no. Don't tell me that's what this is really about. I see the red rims of her eyes, the barely controlled grief and rage. This is about how she feels about me as much as her loss. I'd fooled myself into believing that we were just allies, but for her, it was always more. It was a relationship. I just never saw it that way. She was a means to an end, and she used me in the same measure. I turned to stare in disbelief at Mike.
And you're in this with her.
He's got his stone face on, but I know he's feeling guilty behind that. He has to be.
Look, ma'am, I like Gwen, I do, but I have to put my brother first, and Gwen is never going to shake her past. It's just too heavy. I don't want you going down with her.
So you're okay with her being harassed, stalked, maybe killed, and the kids along with her?
No, he says. I'm not. But I'm also not okay with you being collateral damage.
Hear this woman out. That's all I'm asking.
You don't know her,
I tell him.
Jesus, Miranda, don't you get it? I never loved you. I barely liked you. We had our losses in common. And now it's over.
She doesn't answer immediately. She's slowing the car, and now she's making a turn into a familiar parking lot, the Motel 6.
I'm giving you a choice, Sam. You have a job offer in Florida, a chance to start over and do something positive with your life. Just take it.
I get it then, finally. And it sucks. Mike didn't recommend me for the job, did he? You twisted some corporate arms, got me a nice cushy position far away from Gwen.
I did recommend you, Mike says. I want you alive, man. And I don't see that happening if you stay on this path.
He sounds genuinely unhappy about this. I think he really is. He never liked Miranda and her crusade. He never liked who I was when I was part of it, though he never gave up on me either. I understand why he's done this now. But he's completely fucking wrong. I listen to the engine idle. I count pulse beats because it keeps me calm when I want to rip this car to pieces.
You have a choice to change your life, Miranda says. I'm driving Mike back to the Nashville airport. If you say yes, I have a private jet ready there to fly you to Florida. Mike and I will get these charges dropped against you because it's obvious you're not a murderer. You were defending yourself, and the state police's investigation will fully bear that out. You take that job. You find someone else. You heal from what she's done to you. And you never, ever come back.
Or? I asked tightly.
Or you get out of the car and wait for Gina. I swear to God, if you make that choice, I will make it my personal mission to destroy you both, she says. I will make you and Gina Royal so toxic, so poisonous that everyone that touches you is destroyed by association.
Scorched earth. She means it. I hear Mike protest that, but I'm not listening. He might not have realized what she intended, but he bought into this, and he stays in for the full ride.
You can't do that, I tell her.
I even manage to be gentle about it.
You can't punish innocent kids like that. I look forward to the day someone destroys those children the way Melvin destroyed mine. Then I can rest, because the last trace of Melvin Royal will be gone from this earth.
It's horrific, but she means it. I know this woman. I cared for her once, and seeing the fanaticism, the cruelty, it's like looking into a mirror and seeing myself 2 years ago. You're insane, I say. I'm actually sorry for her, and frightened of her. You'd go that far.
I would go to hell to punish Gina Royal, she said. And if you get out of this car, Sam, that's where you're going to.
I look from her to Mike. He looks nakedly appalled now. He didn't know she'd do this, or take it this far. I feel sorry for him for a tiny second before I remember that he's trying to pull me away from the people I love.
See you both in hell, then, I tell them, and I open the door and get out.
I watch the car drive away. Dawn's showing on the eastern horizon, but the morning is oddly cold for the season. Ghosts escaping the ground. I sit down against the wall at the Motel 6, and I wait for whatever will come for me now. If it's the Wolf Hunter PD, I'll be dead before I see the sun. But if it's a choice between watching Gwen suffer or suffering with her, I'll be with her every time. I'm sitting there half an hour before they show up. Three men, not here to mind their own business because they look around, see me, and head right over. The one in the middle of the trio is a lanky red-haired man with a thick, unkempt beard. The other two are shorter, both with dark hair and beards. Under all the hair, I see a resemblance. I don't know them, and they damn sure shouldn't know me.
Fellas, I say.
I don't get up. I'm tired.
We really have to do this right now?
I expect them to lead with the obvious, the killing of their local hero, Travis, but they surprise me. The big red-headed one says,
Where is she?
Gwen? I shrug. Why?
We got a date,
he says, and laughs the way a donkey brays.
Bitch is gonna suck my dick, I hear.
He stops laughing, because he sees it's not working. I really don't want to do this. I really don't. I feel sick and lost and utterly not in the mood. Until he says,
Not the mother. I wouldn't do her with 1,000 condoms. I'm talking about that fine daughter.
Everything else stops. The exhaustion, the depression, the fear that I can't quite suppress. I stand up.
You mean my daughter?
Because she is. And I'm not letting this asshole get away with it.
Nice mouth you got. You kiss your brother with that?
Not surprisingly, they come for me. They were only waiting for the excuse. It's not like the damn movies where two wait politely while the first one has a go at you. They rush me in a jumbled, stumbling group, and two of them keep my right arm pinned back while the third, the big one, slams a fist the size of a coffee can into my stomach so hard I feel it up my spine. I take it, because I'm trying to spot their weaknesses, other than lack of discipline. The big one's ungainly, enlisting his weight to the right. Easy fix. I gag back the pain of his punch, raise my work boot, and slam it into the side of his right knee. I feel the crunch of tearing cartilage, and his high-pitched scream echoes off the concrete bricks of the motel court. He hops backward, howling and crashing into the wall, where he leans and keeps making noise. Not down, but for now, out of the fight. The two limpets locked onto my right arm stare at their friend in shock. All I have to do to shake them off is punch my left fist into the side of the first guy's head, grab him by the hair, and introduce him to the point of my knee,
which breaks his nose and sends him reeling back to fall in the corner. One left, nobody holding me back. I don't feel pain right now. I feel a deep, almost sickening joy that I'm laying these guys out, and he can see it. He holds up both hands and backs off. I'm surprised that when I speak, my voice sounds pretty even. "Hey, fellas, let me ask you a question. Who put you up to this?" The one with the broken nose tries to curse at me, but breaks into a coughing fit that sprays blood. I wince, and also feel a savage rush of satisfaction. Redbeard says, in a voice that sounds like he's grinding rocks in the back of his throat,
"Asshole!"
He manages to give it the Tennessee twang even on two syllables.
"Everybody knows you're part of it."
Part of what? I'm expecting it to be about this town, about Travis getting shot. But it isn't.
"You're Melvin Royal's little errand boy," he says. "Everybody knows that. You and her together, helping him get those girls. You're fucking dead."
After he says it, I hear a white noise buzz, like I've taken a blow to the head. I just look at him without any real comprehension. Then the sickness creeps in. Jesus Christ. I take a breath and let it out. I feel unsteady now.
"Where did you hear this?"
"Bar,"
says Redbeard. The man still holding up his hand says,
"Somebody said it on Facebook."
I turn on him.
"Who the hell said it? Why?"
The man whose nose is ruined spits blood and grins with pink teeth.
"You gonna go fuck her up too?"
Her. My immediate sickening thought is this comes directly from Miranda. This is the kind of thing she'd launch. Pure propaganda with no truth in it at all. An accusation without backup, without merit, spreading fast. And one thing I know about people from deep personal experience, they're happy to jump on the hate train if it makes them feel like fucking heroes. I grab the uninjured man by the shoulder and say,
"Show me."
He pulls out a surprisingly good cell phone and navigates with shaking fingers, then thrusts it toward me. I read the post. It isn't by Miranda, or at least, it doesn't seem to be. It's attributed to a woman who says her name is Doreen Anderson, and the picture is of a blonde, plump woman whose address is listed in Atlanta. Here's Doreen at a bake sale with her kids, at a church social, posing with two men, one of whom looks familiar to me, though I can't immediately pinpoint why, until I see the white panel van in the fuzzy background. They're all beaming and giving the thumbs-up sign. The circuit clicks. She's part of the film crew. I check her employment details. She's a bank clerk who's been laid off, as so many have, by the advance of automated tellers. Current occupation is listed as documentarian. Her post strongly implies that I'm some acolyte of Melvin Royals, moving in with Gwen because we have that in common. But nothing is strong enough or directly stated enough to take to court, which I wouldn't do anyway. It would only fan the flames. Lots of "what if he" and "maybe if the two of them were" kind of speculation. What passes for journalism in today's world? Tar sticks. If she meant to cause trouble, mission accomplished. And like Miranda told me, it's just beginning. I flip the phone back to the man who fumbles and drops it. I hope the screens crack.
"You idiot, spread the word at that bar you were talking about. You come for me, or for Gwen, or our kids, and you won't walk away next time. You're lucky I didn't kill all three of you. Now fuck off."
"Faggot."
Redbeard spits at me. Misses because my reflexes are still pretty good. "Pretty pathetic. That's still your go-to insult, big man. That ligament's fried, by the way. You'd better get it fixed if you ever want to walk without a limp."
"My nose is broke,"
the second man volunteers, like it's not obvious. He doesn't sound so much combative as sad.
"It's fucking broke."
I just nod. The three of them shuffle off around the corner, with the still-whole third man helping Redbeard hop along, and Broken Nose trying to stop the streaming of blood with the sleeve of his denim jacket. Unsuccessfully. There's a good chance they'll go straight to the police and get my bail revoked, but I can't help that. If the Wolf Hunter police want to find me, nothing I can really do about it. At least I'll cost Miranda her $250,000. That's petty revenge, but hey, revenge. I'm starting to walk off towards the woods to find a place to piss when a white, boxy sedan I don't recognize pulls into the motel parking lot. I don't pay a lot of attention to it because I'm starting to feel the adrenaline wearing off and exhaustion setting in again, until it pulls in abruptly in front of me. I step back, reaching for a gun I don't actually have anymore, and then I realize that Gwen's driving the car. We look at each other for a long, telling moment, and then I glance into the back. The kids are inside, quiet and subdued.
"Get in," Gwen says. "Let's get out of here."
"There's no place to go," I tell her, "and we need to talk, now."
Chapter 14. Gwen. Sam doesn't look right. He seems pale and tired and deeply unhappy, lines on his face I haven't seen before. I don't know what he sees when he leans down to look at me through the open door of the car, but he gets in and slams it shut. I immediately start driving. "Where are you going?" he asks me. He even sounds exhausted. Hasn't slept, I'm sure. Like me, he's worn thin with it. "Away from all this bullshit in this damn town. Mike called me. He said you were out on bail and where to pick you up. Where is he?" Sam doesn't answer. "Never mind, let's go home." "Home isn't a refuge," he says. "Stop the car." I haven't pulled out of the motel parking lot yet, just made the turnaround. I pull the rental into a space. "What?" I have the feeling I'm not going to like this, at all. He hesitates for a long moment, and then he says, "I don't want the kids to hear this." "I'm pretty sure we need to," my daughter says. "Enough with the secrets, we're not babies." But they always will be, to me. Tiny little bundles of sweet, new skin and kicking feet and waving hands that need protection from the world. I feel breathless because Sam wouldn't have said that if it wasn't serious, if it wasn't something that would change everything. But he takes Lanny at her word. He leans up against the passenger side door to look at me, and at them, too. Then he tells us the truth. "Miranda Tidewell and I used to be close," he said. "I lived with her for a while. Before you assume anything, it was just, I needed a place to stay, and she provided a room in her house. A guest room." "For how long?" I ask him. "From the time I got back from deployment until I moved to Stillhouse Lake," he says. "I told you that I went there thinking I'd prove that you had something to do with Melvin's crimes. That was true. I just didn't tell you that I had funding." "Funding," I repeat. "From Miranda. And I guess she's finally realized she's not getting value for her investment." I feel something catch inside me, sharp as a fish hook. He's only ever talked about it as his own decision, not that it was any kind of shared secret, shared with her. "She knew you were coming to Stillhouse Lake to hurt me. Put me in prison if you could do that." "Yes." Connor says,
"The woman on TV? That one? You lived with her?"
"I did." His voice breaks. He doesn't want to admit this to Connor. "There's more. I put together the Lost Angels group. It started with the two of us, then pulled in the families and friends of Melvin's other victims. If we didn't get everyone, we got close. It was meant to be a place to heal, but that's not what it turned into."
"Sam,
I know about the Lost Angels group, and I feel a crawling horror beneath my skin."
"No.
No. I started it," he says. "Miranda and I did that to you."
"God, Gwen."
I can see how long he's carried the secret, and how much it hurts him. I can feel sorry for him, even as he's cutting my heart in two. "At first it was just talk, just internet bullshit to make ourselves feel better. Then I made the wanted posters. I found out where you were living after you changed your name." He looks ill now. "We came back every day to put them up. For weeks, we tracked you." I want to throw up. I brace myself on the steering wheel. I remember how happy I was to get my kids back with me, how safe and warm our new refuge felt after my acquittal. We'd started over. I believed in the goodness and forgiveness of people then. I'd really thought we could move on without the stench of Melvin's evil following us. And then wanted posters with my picture went up around our neighborhood, accusing me of rape, torture, and murder. They were stuffed in our mailbox. They were nailed to our front door, to the doors of my kids' school. To hear that Sam did that, it burns something to ash inside me. He destroyed our safety. He pushed us to run for our lives, because after that first time it all went viral, beyond anyone's control. Reddit went mad with speculation about how deep my involvement went in the murders, and concluded that I was the mastermind, that Melvin was just my patsy. We were relentlessly doxxed from that point on. No safe spaces. The Lost Angels and the army of rabid assholes who followed after them began sending us more and more violent imagery and fantasies about our deaths. I realize, with a horrible jolt, that Sam sent those too. He must have, in the beginning. It's never stopped. Every day, the sicko patrol floods my inbox. Sam is the real author of our misery. I don't even know how to process the depth of that betrayal, even if it was done before we ever really met. There are tears in my eyes now, cold enough to freeze. It hurts. Everything hurts. How could you not tell me? How could you make me trust you? What kind of sick game are you playing now? I can barely feel my body. I'm sick enough to faint, but I don't. I cling grimly to the world, this ugly, broken world, and I say, "You asked me to marry you. Did she tell you to do that? Marry me, then break me? Or maybe just kill?" I can't continue. It hurts too much. My voice is shaking. I'm shaking. And I realize, oh God, that I've not told the kids he proposed, that my children are witnesses and victims now, that I should have done as he asked and stepped out of the car to listen to this confession, because this is going to destroy them. They trusted him. I turn to look at them. Connor's head is down, and I know that posture. He's guarding himself against the pain. Lanny is staring at Sam, and there's pure horror on her face. It sharpens into rage. "You bastard," she says. "You monster." She's quoting her father's letter. "You don't know who he is, Gina. You don't know what he's capable of doing. I'm laughing at the thought that you only bring monsters into your bed. You deserve that." Maybe I do. My children don't. Sam's face has gone starkly pale now, his gaze still on me. "I came here to hurt you in the beginning, and yes, Miranda knew. But then things changed. They changed. And when I say I love you and I love these kids, I'm telling you nothing but the truth. I understand why you said no to me. I get it. But please, please believe me." I hear the pain in his voice. I see it in his eyes, glittering with tears like the ones running down my cheeks. All this is said in quiet tones, but I want to scream and keep on screaming until the world stops. I've never imagined Sam as the kind of monster Melvin was until this moment. But now it's all too clear. All too real. Because he's hurt us just as much. "I don't believe you," I tell him. "Miranda just paid your bail, didn't she?" He makes a sound like I've gutted him. For a moment he doesn't move except to bow his head. He just breathes. I wait. If he reaches out toward me, toward either of my children, I will grab that arm and break it. I will keep twisting, and he'll bend forward and I'll crush his throat with a hard, straight fist. The sequence is clear to me, but his face isn't there when I try to imagine it. It's just a blank space. Because right at this moment, I can't fathom who the man sitting across from me really is. He opens the car door and lunges out, like he can't wait to get away from me. But then he staggers and has to lean against the car, on Lanny's side. He doubles over and braces himself with palms on his thighs and gasps for air.
go, Lanny says. Just drive, Mom. There are tears running down my daughter's face. I want to go home. I've failed them. Again. I don't know how to ever make this right. Okay, I tell her. We will. Before I can put the car in gear, Connor opens his door and gets out. I freeze because I don't know what he's doing until he walks around the car, faces Sam, and says, Are you telling us the truth now? Everything? Are you sure? Sam nods. He's still trembling and trying to breathe. I can't imagine what my son is feeling, but I don't want to stop him. I can't. Mom! Lanny hits the back of my seat with a hard fist. Do something! Get him back in the car and let's go! Connor? He's not listening to me. I climb out of the driver's side. Connor, get back in the car. But my son's ignoring me, and Lanny, who's going ballistic in the car. He's watching Sam with steady focus. Then he says, I understand. He's not talking to me. He's talking to Sam. They're mad. I'm mad, too. But it's easy for somebody to tell you what you need to hear. I listened to my father, even when I knew better. He swallows, and I can see how nervous he is, and how much it takes for him to do this. We knew who you were before. It's not different. It's just more. Kid, Sam hangs his head. You should get back in the car. Your mom and sister want to go home. I want to say something, but I can't. There's something happening here, and it's important. Connor says, You hated us once. Then you got better. I still believe you. It hurts. Everything's in chaos inside me now, whirling edges of steel that cut and cut and cut. Connor's a child. He's just a child. He can't understand. But in some ways, my son understands more than I ever will. Sam lets out a tortured gasp, and he grabs my son into a hug so fierce it makes me ache. Connor hugs him back, and I know that look. I've felt it all the way down. I know the loss and the fear, and most of all, the love. Sam loves my son. He really does. Mom! Lanny gets out of the car now. She's pale and frightened and unsure what's going on, and I put an arm around her and pull her close. Mom, Connor can't just forgive him. But she's wrong, and I see it like a sudden flash of sunlight. There's something beautiful in front of me, something precious. Nobody earns this, but Sam deserves it. Lanny, I say quietly, Connor's right. Mom, we can't trust him. I know that. There's not a reason in the world to trust him except what he's done since coming to us. At no point has he hurt us except when his past has come to light. At no point has he done anything but be my partner, protector, champion. That isn't an act. It can't be an act. Because I'm seeing the consequences right now, in real time, for being truthful. He knew this would happen, and he told us anyway. That's brave. That's the Sam I know. Sam kisses my son on the top of the head and says, I love you, Connor. Remember that, okay? Connor steps back. You can't leave. But I have to, Sam says. Don't I? Sam and I look at each other from opposite sides of the car. I catch my breath on another surge of real pain. I can see the heartbreak in him, the damage done. Sam, I tell him, get in the damn car. He blinks. I see the flash of hope, and then it's gone. Miranda, you said she'd destroy us. Don't let her. It's too late, isn't it? I honestly don't know. You can't just go. You don't have money or any way to get out of town, unless Mike... No, he interrupts me. Mike's with her.
I don't know what to say. I'm not the only one who's been betrayed today. He was already hurting. Now it's worse. He's as alone as he's ever been, I think. You're right. She did bail me out, he says. She and Mike gave me a choice. I chose you. I chose this. If he's telling the truth, it's the biggest thing that anyone has ever done for us. And despite the gulf between us, despite the pain of what he did that feels new and raw, even if it's years past now, I can't ignore that. Lanny whispers, Mom? Mom, but what he did... It's what he's doing now that counts, I tell her, and turn to look right at her. Do you trust me? She nods, unwillingly. There are tears glittering in her eyes. She's confused and hurt. I understand that. I turn back to Sam. When I speak again, my voice is gentler. Please get in the goddamn car. He stares at me for a second, frozen. He drags in a breath and wipes the heel of hands across his face. I'm sorry, he says. I know that. I wait until he's getting back in before I join him. Connor gets in behind us. That just leaves my daughter. She hesitates, glares at me, and then slides into the back seat. Thank you, I tell her. Lanny crosses her arms and looks away. Not ready yet, but she will be. I hope. We're not a family, but we're together, and that's a new start. Please tell me we're leaving this damn place, Lanny says. Can you? I ask Sam. He shrugs as he fastens his seatbelt. The bail, it's Miranda's money. That's enough to make me accelerate. We are 15 minutes out when my phone rings. I look at the name. I intend to blow it off, but it's Hector Sparks, and I feel obligated to answer. I put it on speaker. Gwen Proctor. Ms. Proctor, I need your assistance immediately. You have to find her. He sounds breathless. Find who? Vera Crockett, he says. She's escaped, and I think she's in very great danger. What? How the hell did she? The police claim they were careless, he says. He sounds nervous, and it sounds like he's pacing the floor. But I think they were very deliberate in allowing her to get away. She was left unattended in the van at the courthouse. I believe this is a plot to have her silenced. Now that she's on the run, she can easily be killed. Because of what she knows? I sharpen my tone. After talking to her, my whole family is on the same list. Don't you realize that? Did you know this would mean whoever killed Marlene would also come after us, or are you just that stupid? Sparks is quiet for a moment. Then he says, I can turn to no one else in this town for help. Not a single person. If you find V and bring her to my house, I promise you that I can and will keep all of you safe. But she has to be found. Now! Miss Proctor, I am not exaggerating when I tell you that this girl has no chance without our help. Damn it. I should keep going. I don't owe this girl anything. I don't. I look at my daughter in the rearview mirror. Her lips are parted. All her defensiveness is gone. She's staring at me as if she expects me to do something. And right now I can't bear to let her down. I turn the car around. I know where she's going, Lanny says. How could you possibly? She's going to her mom's house. She's scared. And she knows they'll kill her. That's where she'd go, right? My kid's smart. Smarter than I am. Because it makes perfect sense. And it makes me wonder if Lanny's thought about ending things. If she's ever been that desperate and alone. Then I know, from the look in her eyes, she has. Of course she has. With the life she's been forced to lead. That's a wound that Sam and I inflicted together for very different reasons. I have to make damn sure I don't let her down. The police are doing a grid search, fanning out from the courthouse. It won't take them long to make it to the taped-off Crockett house. I head straight there and slide to a stop at the curb. No police cruisers in sight so far. I see that the tape that once sealed the front door, the one with the shotgun blast through it, has been ripped off and is flapping in the breeze by one corner. "Stay here," I order, and I'm directing it at everyone, but no one listens to me. As I run for the door, I look back. Sam's coming. And worse, so is my daughter. I slow as I come up the front steps. V tried to kill the last person who surprised her. I gesture for the other two to stay back, and I enforce it with a scorching look. Sam grabs Lanny and pulls her to a halt. I proceed carefully, slowly. The house is worse than I'd imagined. A leaning, neglected thing with a half-rotten porch with no railing. The front door creaks as I ease it back. The stench of old blood hits me and I try not to gag. "V," I say. "V, are you here? It's Gwen." I look back at Sam, who's still holding Lanny back. I point to the car, to Connor, who's hesitating next to it. I mouth, "Look after them." Sam nods and goes back. No hesitation. I send him a silent thanks for not second-guessing me, and I realize that he rarely does. That's a gift he's been quietly giving me this whole time, and I never saw it. I step inside. The place is dim, rank with the smell of death, and yet oddly neat. Marlene tried, I think. The carpet is worn but clean. Pictures of Vera as a little girl hang on the wall, along with a set of plaster praying hands and a simple cross. Vera is sitting in an old rocking chair, hunched over, motionless. She's still wearing the jail jumpsuit we saw her in before. Her hair hangs lank over her face. As my eyes adjust, I see she's got something in her hands. A knife. That's when Lanny slams breathlessly through the front door. "I'm not waiting in the car!" Oh, God. I step between the threat and Lanny. "V, please put the knife down." I hear Lanny slide to a stop. She realizes the situation, and at least she holds back from doing anything more impulsive.